Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Cheryl Finley. Finley received her PhD in African American Studies and Art History from Yale University. She is currently an assistant professor of art history at Cornell. Much of her teaching and research is focused on African American and Afro-Caribbean art history. She also has an important book coming out from Princeton University Press called Committed to Memory, The Slave Ship Icon in the Black Atlantic Imagination. And welcome to the show, Cheryl.
Thank you so much for having me here today, Tish.
Now, I want to start with, what was it that originally got you interested in art history specifically?
Well, I was surrounded by art all of my life. When I was growing up, I grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland. And my father is a photographer, but was a dentist by training. My mother teaches computer science at the University of the District of Columbia. They met at Howard University in the mid-1950s, and when they were there, they were friends with artists who were on campus, and they often went to the Howard University Art Department, which is renowned for its teaching. People like Porter, who wrote one of the earliest histories of African American art, as well as David Driscoll, and other artists of note have gone through Howard University and made it a really wonderful program. When they were there, they purchased work from students who had student exhibitions, and this is work that still hangs in my mother's home and that I was surrounded by as a child. So if I think about my earliest interest in art or art history, it probably comes from being surrounded by works of art that sometimes I didn't understand, or that I understood with sort of a child's mind or a child's eye. And one of the works that I can remember best is one that I called as a child The Pots and the Pans. Mm. And it's a painting. I can't remember the name of the artist right now, but it's a painting that was maybe about 4 feet high by 6 feet long. And it hung for a long time in the stairwell. And I would see it going upstairs and downstairs. And it's a horizontal work. Well, it's actually not a set of pots and pans hanging from racks, say, on a wall or above a stove in a kitchen. Instead, it is a saxophone turned on its side. And so what you see are the pedals or the keys of the saxophone that look like pots or frying pans
I
hanging
know that
upside
image.
Down.
Wow.
So trying to figure out, okay, what was I seeing as a child? And what is it now, looking at the difference between something that might be abstract or something that is a photograph or even a portrait for that matter.
So you wanted to find out what all this stuff meant many ways.
And one of the other, it was not an early discovery, but probably a later discovery when I became an art historian, is that one of the works that my parents purchased is a portrait, sort of a parody, on the late James A. Porter, to whom I referred earlier, who was a renowned African-American scholar of art history at Howard University. And so it was a painting that was done by one of his students, sort of as a humorous sort of thing. And that now hangs over the piano at my mother's house.
Oh, that's great. It comes full circle. Now, were you always interested in African-American art, or was there a little bit of everything that you were focusing on?
I was also interested in photography, and I remain interested in photography. When I was in college, actually in high school, my father gave me a camera, and I mentioned to you before that he is also a photographer, and later in life photographed jazz legends. Earlier in life, when he spent some time in the Caribbean and Trinidad, he photographed people and the environments there. But I was interested in photography, too, as trying to be an artist, and I'll put that in quotation marks, even as a high school student. And when I was in college at Wellesley, my work study position was actually a position in the art department where I showed slides to almost every art history course that was ever offered at Wellesley, from the great survey courses like Art 100 and Art 101 to Romanesque art to a really wonderful seminar on the art and politics of the nude and so on. So that's another, to kind of get back to your earlier question, another way in which I really became interested in art history. I was not an art history major in college. I was a Spanish major. Mm-hmm. But when I was there, I studied photography And at one point kind of hoped that I would be a photographer, a photographic artist when I finished.
Well, we need art historians too. Now I do want to talk about some of your research projects. You do have a book coming out at some point called Committed to Memory, The Slave Ship Icon in the Black Atlantic Imagination. Tell us about this. When you talk about that picture that everybody knows from the slave ships, I immediately knew what you were talking about. Tell us about it.
Right. I mean, it's a book that is really the first cultural history of this black and white schematic image that has hundreds of small black figures packed into an architectural schematic of a slave ship, as if you were kind of looking over and seeing a crowded hold of very still, almost very lifeless bodies, almost as if you may be looking into a huge coffin or a mass grave. It's an image that when I was in graduate school, I came across when I was doing a research project, but an image that when I came across it, I immediately knew that I had seen it before. It was probably in a junior high school or a high school textbook, and a history textbook that probably had a scant number of pages dedicated to black history, but used that image as sort of the punctuation mark, if you will, to describe the black experience in the United States. And originally, when I applied to do my PhD at Yale, I was interested in doing a project that would probably have something to do with photography, possibly have something to do with the art market and collecting. I actually decided to go to graduate school after having been out of college for almost a decade. And it was at a point in my career as an art consultant and an art appraiser working in New York City that I identified really a need for more scholars of African-American art, of art of the African diaspora, in such a way as to be able to, on the one hand, educate people who may become sort of the next generation of art historians, or even artists for that matter, who would be teaching this kind of material and showing why images and certain kinds of images are relevant, teaching people how to read images. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as someone who was very much involved in the commercial side of the art business, I was also very interested in even educating those who might go to college and become business majors and become, you know, who knows, the next, you know, wealthy baron of Wall Street, but someone who might be interested in supporting the arts and supporting work by African and African-American artists or even museums. At the time, the National Museum of African-American History and Culture, which is still sort of it's been established, but the building isn't there. It had not yet been established. So this is why I became interested in graduate school. Mm-hmm. And the project that I thought I would do, I would have something to do with those kinds of interests. Now, I mentioned that I came across the image that I call the slave ship icon. It has other names that other historians refer to it by, including a description of a slave ship, because it was a very descriptive broadside that not only had the image that I mentioned to you before that we all know, like the backs of our hands, but also a descriptive text. And it was a very scientific kind of image that also mentioned the amount of space that every man, woman, and child would have on a slave ship. It mentioned daily routines. It mentioned instances of torture and so on and so forth. But I came across this image when I was taking a course in graduate school in the History of Art department that was a course on the long 18th century and the culture of consumption that developed in England during the long 18th century. And while the professor teaching the course had not only referenced but given us readings that related to and sort of in a way implied that the wealth that was gained from the slave trade as England became increasingly involved in the slave trade during the 18th century was something that contributed to this culture of consumption. I felt that my classmates really did not wish to discuss this in great detail.
It's a painful image.
It is.
It's an absolutely painful image
to
see that human cargo.
Yes.
And when you think about it in terms of emotion, the thought of these people packed in like that is just so frightening.
Right. And it was a painful and shocking image, particularly in the late 18th century in 1789 when it was first published, because it was published in England, where slave ships would be outfitted there, and they would leave from ports like Liverpool and London and Bristol and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. But slavery itself as an institution, chattel slavery, was not something that was visible on the shore. So it was very shocking to those who saw it. I was mentioning this course to say that I was inspired to feel like I had to do something in my own work, in the assignments that were given to us, to try to help others see that this was an important issue that had to be considered. That is, the influence and the importance of the slave trade and the money that was reaped from mm-hmm. it by England during this time as an influence on this idea of the consumption of culture.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking at this as somebody from art history or from politics? Because it seems to me that it melds the two in some ways.
Well,
the abolitionist movement started after this image started surfacing, didn't it?
Right. Well, it was part and parcel of the abolitionist movement, and it's really the main image that kind of kicks off a second wave of abolitionism, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely is an image that's situated deeply in politics, but it's also deeply situated in many histories of art. One might be the revolution in print culture that occurs around the very same time. So that one of the reasons that I call this image the slave ship icon, one of the reasons that it becomes iconic in its own time from about 1789 when it's first introduced to the British public, to France, and also to England at the very same time until 1807 when the slave trade is abolished, is because that the abolitionists in England at the London Committee were able to send out printing blocks to different committees around the countryside to enable them to print their own copies. So there was a certain way in which it was an egalitarian sort of image, one that was able to be very easily reproduced by a number of different committees, not only in the UK, but also in the US. As I mentioned, when it came out in 1789, in May, there were copies sent immediately to Philadelphia, and an engraver in Philadelphia by the name of Matthew Carey reproduced the very same image. But one thing that he did that was very interesting, speaking of politics, was that in the text that he included in it was called the American Museum, the publication that it was published in his text, instead of outlining an argument for the abolition of the slave trade, that is the commerce, he outlined an argument for the abolition of slavery. And so he sort of changed the words that went along. He kind of included most of what was there, but he changed the words because there was, you know, in the United States, of course, slavery was what they wanted to have abolished. And, of course, in the U.K., abolitionists would have argued that they also wanted slavery to be abolished in the islands in the Caribbean, but they felt that abolishing the slave trade first would be more expedient, and then the next step would be to abolish slavery.
Now, before we do run out of time, you studied the Black Arts Movement in the U.S. You've written papers on it and so on. And did you find out how this image influenced some of those artists that were part of the Black Arts Movement?
Oh, yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about that.
I did, sure. Thanks to actually a colleague of mine at Cornell, Margot Crawford, who's a professor in the English department. She and another art historian, Lisa Gail Collins, who's at Vassar, published a book called New Thoughts on the Black Arts Movement. It came out in 2007. And it inspired me to design a new course, thinking about the Black Arts Movement, not just in the visual arts or not just in the literary arts, which is usually, those are sort of the two domains in which many people often study it or write about it. I was also interested in music and I was interested in film. And this is a course that I've taught here at Cornell and at Harvard, and I now teach it with Patrine Archer-Straw, who's a colleague of mine in the History of Art department, as an online offering through Cornell, and we'll be teaching it this June. I'm plugging that for a minute.
Hold that thought. I'll be right back with you. If you're just joining us, my guest is Cheryl Finley. She's an assistant professor of art history at Cornell University. Go ahead and continue on this thought. I want to talk more about the Black Arts Movement in the U.S. It was quite influential, and it had a beginning and an end, and I want to talk about Both of those.
From approximately 1965 to 1976. And some of the leaders of the Black Arts Movement include Leroy Jones, who's now known as Amiri Baraka, and Larry Neal. They're the two major theorists, if you will, who write the manifestos of the Black Arts Movement. And the year 1965 is very significant in that it's also the year that Malcolm X is assassinated. And so there are many poets and writers, as well as visual artists, who are very, very affected by Malcolm X's assassination. And in 1969, speaking about the image of the slave ship again, one of the things that Amiri Baraka does is he begins a play, or rather, it's 1967 that it's actually first performed, a play called Slave Ship, a one-act play. And it's a play that is staged in the round. One of the most famous performances took place at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in 1969. And the very exciting thing about this play, which is a play about, loosely speaking, the Black experience in the United States from leaving the shores of Africa to the present day, that is in 1969, is that in this improvisational work, and when I say improvisational, it's not only improvisational theater and acting, wherein the audience members are also very much involved. There's also improvisational music by people like Archie Shepp and others who were part of this performance. It's staged on a set that was designed by Eugene Lee that is on rockers and that is based on the schematic drawing that Description of the Slave Ship is. And so that's really one of the very first instances, which is, again, 1969. Mm-hmm. But another artist, Malcolm Bailey, who was someone who mostly did minimalist works, who was a young artist at the time, in 1969, he had the inaugural exhibition at Cinque Gallery, named after the leader of the Amistad Revolt in 1839, a gallery that was opened in downtown New York by Romare Bearden, the great African-American collage artist, and a couple of other artists of his generation to showcase the work of young Black artists. Mm-hmm.
And this was political too, right? I mean,
oh, totally.
Totally,
yeah.
Political art.
Right. I mean, at this time, if you think about 1969, I mean, one of the most controversial exhibitions of 1969, taking place in New York City at least, was the Harlem on My Mind exhibition, which was protested by Black artists and Black activists because it was an exhibition that, while it was focused on the Harlem community, it didn't really take into consideration the impact of the current moment on the Harlem community.
And of course, Martin Luther King had been assassinated by then, by 1969 as well.
Exactly, uh-huh. Exactly. And there were also not, there was no consultation for Harlem on My Mind with Black artists who, at the time, were really trying to argue for a place in mainstream museums and galleries in terms of the way that their work would be either exhibited or collected or even represented, for that matter, or even having the voice of curators as well. So Bailey is an artist who, in his exhibition at the Cinque Gallery in December of 1969, did a work called Hold, Separate but Equal. And it was a work that reimagined this image of the slave ship as sort of almost a blueprint type of image, using a minimalist style, where in his work he imagined not only Black bodies but white bodies in this very same mm-hmm. schematic image. And it was a work that really tried to comment not only on the question of whether or not integration was going to be a successful project. It was one that also suggested that economically Blacks and whites were in the quote-unquote same boat, so to speak, at that very moment.
Now, as an art historian, is it usually art that's tinged with politics that ends up in art history courses? How does one decide what is history and what is taught? Do you have any answer to that?
Well, I mean, I would say my first answer is that all art is political, including Monet's flowers, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What ends up in art history courses? Well, there's survey courses, for example. I also teach a survey course on African American art that begins in 1619 and goes up to the very present. And the choice of the kinds of images and objects that we study is based upon what the culture and what history has left behind for us to study. And so one of the often more difficult parts of the course to teach But the most gratifying is the earlier part of the course where we talk about African American material culture through, for example, plantation architecture.
Mm.
So you talk about the kinds of buildings that enslaved people were made to build and were also made to live in, or those that they were made to build but not allowed to live in. So the comparison, if you will, between the back house or the outhouse and the big house, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, I mean, I'm not going to answer for other art historians, but I think there are many different decisions and factors that go into what makes a course tick, but also what's important to teach. Another example.
In regard to a culture, yeah, I would think one would be picky about what one chooses.
Right, right. And I mean, just to give another current example from my own teaching, I am teaching a course on the Blaxploitation film era of the 1970s.
Oh, fascinating. It's
called Blaxploitation Film and Photography. And thanks to the purchase of a collection of those films by the Africana librarian, Erica Cree, about 5 years or more ago, I have all this material to teach. But if you'll recall, any of the films from this era, including Melvin Van Peebles' classic Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song from 1971, or a film like Superfly directed by Gordon Parks Jr. from 1972, or even Shaft directed by...
I was trying to think of Shaft.
Right, right. So that's 71, Gordon Parks Sr. There's a certain type of image that is proffered by these films. They are heavily masculinist, sexist. There are stereotypes that abound of prostitutes on the one hand, pimps on the other, drug dealers, and so on. And what I wanted to do in teaching this course was to really try to think about ways that we can read these films that will allow students to be able to understand some of these very similar images that we see in popular culture today. So if you think about contemporary rap videos and so on. And so I call it Blaxploitation Film and Photography because I'm interested in reading these films against historic and contemporary photographic images, as well as other images in the history of art, to which they relate very directly,
mm-hmm.
as to allow students to learn how to also think about how they read the black body and how they understand sort of what I see in my work as a hypervisuality of the black body in popular culture. From, you know, a popular rap artist to even the president of the United States and his family. So you have even that range, if you will.
Mm, that sounds fascinating to me. Now you also teach a course called Exhibiting Cultures, Museums, Exhibitions, and Representation and Display.
Yes.
I think that's sort of the title of it. And it's also about people being put on display.
Yes.
Which is about slavery, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to us a little bit about that. That fascinates me. Because when people think about art, they think about museums and displays in museums. Tell us about the
human displays. Well, one of the things that we start out doing in that course, and I'm actually teaching it this semester, it's a seminar, is to think about world's fairs, just as an example. We look at things like collecting, for example, why people are interested in collecting, the kinds of things that they collect initially. That's the first week of the class. And in the second week, we look at world's fairs, and one of the examples that we study quite closely is the 1893 World's Columbian Exhibition in Chicago, wherein a woman who, I think her last name was Green, she was hired to perform as sort of an Aunt Jemima figure to turn over flapjacks, pancakes. And
God,
this actually
now is horrifying,
right,
isn't it?
And this is actually the very beginning of this stereotype, which lasts until this day. And we've all seen how, over time, on the Aunt Jemima pancake box, her image has changed and has been made tamer and less offensive. But it's also an image that many contemporary artists have riffed upon. People like Joe Overstreet or Betty Saar. They reimagine, these are African American artists, reimagine Aunt Jemima in such a way as to try to liberate her from the pancake box.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
in one of Joe Overstreet's works, which is a large construction of a pancake box called The New Jemima from 1964, he actually has her with this machine gun blowing up pancakes on the box cover.
Now that's an image we would rather see, isn't it?
Yes, yes. But at this 1893 Chicago World's Fair, not only was she on display performing, and again, this is a woman who had a white-collar job in Chicago, but who was made to do this. And this was for a company, I'm sorry, I'm not remembering the name right now, but it was a flower company that was in dire straits, and they needed a way to reinvent themselves. And they had just reinvented this self-rising flour, which is the component of Aunt Jemima, the pancake mix.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll remember that World's Fairs are places where often new technologies are presented, and that was one of the new technologies that was being presented. The Ferris wheel was also at the 1893 World's Fair, but they also had little villages set up along the Midway of people from different cultures on display. And so this is one of the ways in which we talk about these kinds of exhibitions that, while we may be thinking about over a century ago, this is something that happened, but there are also examples at places like Colonial Williamsburg and others where we have this sort of performative nature and performance aspect to the kinds of exhibits that are often enacted or reenacted when tourists go to visit. So in that course, we look at not only people on display, but also the relationship in the contemporary moment, often between tourism, heritage tourism, and this type of human display.
That's really horrifying, the thought of that. I'm glad they're not still doing it. Now, I understand that you wanted to be a photographer but decided you had to go into academia and had to have a real career. Do you think you'll ever go back into photography and as a serious artist? Because you know academics can do that.
Yes, I might. I do, every now and again. I have, actually, in when was it? It was right after Katrina in 06. I had some work in an exhibition entitled Engulfed by Katrina in New York. So the answer is I think I probably still go in and out of that. I also have a 2-year-old daughter, and I photograph her all the time. So, but yeah, I might.
Good. I hope so. I hope so. I think we need your vision. Now, we only have about a minute left. Is there anything you're doing research on that we may be hearing about in the near future?
Yes, there are a couple of things. This is not so local, but in Pittsburgh, there's a new African American Cultural Center that has opened, the August Wilson Center, and an exhibition that I've curated along with three other curators will be opening there sometime in mid-June. Based on Wilson's play, Two Trains Running. And the exhibition is set up in a mythical house, if you will, and each of us chose a room. And my exhibition takes place in the kitchen because I think that's where kind of all the action always happens. And it's always around food, but there's always something more. That's where all the heated discussions happen. And it's an African diaspora room. So that's something that I'll be doing, that I have done, and it's going to be available to be seen by the public in about 2 months, month and a half.
Oh, that's great. Well, Cheryl Finley, thank you so much for joining us, and we look forward to your book coming
out
sometime soon.
It's great to be here and talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.